Okay, so last time we started out by talking about why we didn't just have ASLR since the beginning of time, and the big reason was that there was a cost, and the cost is that we have to write code that can be placed at random places in memory, and kind of our natural assembly doesn't do that, and it more doesn't do that when we have our instruction set not really designed to let us do that, which was the case, for example, for 32-bit x86. The instruction set really was designed under the assumption you'd have hard-coded addresses everywhere. When AMD made the 64-bit version, they fixed this for the most part, but this was a real problem. It meant that just turning on position and independent code, yeah, it's just a compiler change, and you just change a compiler flag, but it wasn't cheap. And a theme we'll probably see a bunch more times in the semester, since my next topic on the schedule is bounds checking, is that people are kind of willing to accept much smaller costs for security than you might think. If you have something that prevents arbitrary code execution, and it's going to make programs take up 10% more memory and run 10% slower, you will probably have trouble getting people to use it, is the history of this field. Even though that seems kind of ridiculous. Like, wouldn't you like your web server not to be exploited, with a pretty higher probability for that cost? The answer is usually no. It just seems empirically the answer is no, even though there's not a logical reason for it. So then we talked about kind of the workaround for the kind of simplest mitigation we talked about so far, which is this write XOR execute idea. This idea that we can mark memory as non-executable once our hardware finally supports doing that, which it does now, but it didn't in like 2000. And that means that we need to find an alternative, I should say, sorry, to our shellcode idea. So we had this idea with our prior exploits that we find some way to jump to an arbitrary location. How would we use that? We'd write code, put it at that location. If we can't write code, then we have to find stuff in the existing program. And in some very occasional cases, we'll just find the exact thing we want to run already in the program. We saw that with kind of arc injection, where we replaced, say, string len with system, and now the program just runs a shell command, which is probably what the attacker wanted to do anyway. But, usually our programs won't be quite so friendly. And when they're not, it turns out we can still usually do what we want. And this is with this idea that we have these gadgets, these little pieces of code in the program, that kind of occur naturally, and we can string them together to get the effect we want. So we might not be able to find something that runs our shell command, but we can find something which calls the function that runs the shell command, something that loads the arguments for a function, and some way to connect them to each other. And doing this is the idea of return-oriented programming. And it's so named because the way we're going to string these gadgets together is we'll find these snippets of code that end with a return. And so this means, in effect, we're writing kind of a program on the stack. But rather than our program being machine code, our program is this sequence of addresses to jump to of these gadgets and values for these gadgets to pop from the stack. And we'll chain these together, and it turns out these occur in like pretty much any program, so we'll have a whole bunch of options, and this will pretty much let us do what we want to do in most practical scenarios where we have a way of overwriting things on the stack, and we don't have to worry about stack canaries, either because there are no stack canaries or because we did some information disclosure to get the stack canary value. So last time we finished on this exercise, which I didn't fully explain. So here, my goal is to run system bin sh. I'm going to want to run this function call. And I know for our setup, the address of our system function And I have found these bunches of gadgets that all end in a return. And I know the address of some global variable. And the design I'm going to use is I just need some scratch space to put bin sh. So our sort of plan is going to be step one is going to be write bin sh to some temporary space. That's step one of our plan. Step two of our plan is place a pointer to that temp space in RDI, which is the first argument. And step three is run system. So that's the plan I'm going to use to actually do this. And so I just need to find places to do each of these one, two, and three steps. Step three is the easiest, to run system. We just set it as a return value of whatever step two is doing. So we just plot that address on the stack. So for step one, we're going to have some extra steps, some steps, I should say. So for step one, we have this tool, which is the only way in the gadgets I've shown here to actually write to some temporary location. Now, in practice, if we look at a real executable, it probably will turn out we have a whole bunch of options, and we'll need to decide which one do we want to try to use to write somewhere. But here, we only have one option, so our choice is easy. And to use this gadget, we have to solve some sub-problems. To make this work, we have to solve, first, we have to set RAX to the address of the temp space. And we have to set RDI to the value to write. So those are two sub-problems we need to solve to use that write gadget. So then we need to look for gadgets that let us set RAX and set RDI. And our solutions for that are we have these two here. They will read a value from the stack. We control what's on the stack, so we can control what that value is. So we can use that to set RAX and set RDI. And then for step, so that gives us the substeps A and B. And C is run the OX100100 gadget. Questions? Well, so that's our first part of our plan, is writing bin sh somewhere useful. Then we want to load the address of that location into RDI. We already found a way of setting RDI as part of our subproblem. We're going to reuse that. And that's kind of a common theme you'll see in these return-oriented programming chains, is that we're not going to find the unique thing for each step. We're going to find these reusable tools. So setting RDI is something we're going to have a lot of reasons to do. Once we find a way of doing it, great. We'll just use that over and over and over again. So we'll use this gadget to do step two, and to do step three, we just run system. So that gives me this chain of values we write to the stack. And kind of the format this would actually have on the stack is that this we would have in our buffer overflow, we'd have a sequence of numbers such that this overwrites the return address and is popped, and as we pop, popping goes to increasing addresses. So it goes in this direction. So as we pop things from the stack, like returning to OX100200 will move the stack pointer from where the return address is. So our initial stack pointer is going to be here, and it's gonna move to higher addresses, so down this page, as we execute this code, you know, after the overflow. So this is what we set up on the stack using our buffer overflow, you know, where our, you know, our buffer is up here, the intended part of the buffer, and this is all after the buffer, the return address, and stuff after the return address. Some questions? So let's go through what the execution looks like. So first, we're going to overwrite the return address, 2.2.0x100200. So the return is going to go and set the program counter, so we're executing the pop instruction. And when the pop instruction runs, RSP is pointing to the next thing on the stack, which is the value 0x200000. So the pop, when it finishes, is going to load that into RAX. Then we're going to return, and the return is going to be reading the stack pointer that pop is advanced to the next thing on the stack. So we're going to return to address 100300. And so the next instruction we run will be this pop instruction with the value of binsh, which we have to write as an 8-byte integer. So this needs to be encoded as 8 bytes number. Which notably means there's actually a little padding on that string. So we're going to put that into RDI, and then when we execute the return, the stack pointer is at the 100100, so that's where we're going to go next. So then we run the move instruction with our stack pointer currently pointing to the next thing we want to do, but we're not going to look at the stack for the move instruction. The move instruction is just going to say, copy this value into that memory location. Then we're going to return, and the return is going to read from the stack the next address, that's the 100300. That's going to run next the pop instruction with our stack pointer at the next value. So we're going to reload 2000, we're going to load 2000 into RDI. Then we're going to return and call system. Yeah, the return is going to go to system. So the system function is going to run, and RDI is set to pointing to memory at which we just loaded the string binsh. Some questions? Idea. Yes.
So just to clarify, so return, it like it moves the stack pointer down, but then it also like sends the PC to like a different point.
Yes.
So how so we're executing which instruction are we executing after the return?
The return executes the instruction that the thing points to. So return is equivalent to I'll do it here. To basically pop temp jump to temp. So for example, in this case, here, I'll do this example. In this case, the return is going to read the value 100300 as the temporary, and then we're going to jump to that memory location. So the instruction after the return executed is the pop RDI. That 100300 points to. And maybe to get a more complete picture, right, we have our stack. And usually I draw the stack with higher addresses on top of the page. Here we'll have increasing addresses to be consistent with that. So we have our stack, and we have our stack pointer is here, and this points to our gadget with the next pop to execute, and we're currently executing the previous gadget where we have a return, so the return is going to jump to there based on reading that value from the stack and the stack pointer. So, and this is the, here's the stack pointer after return. where this and above is the stack pointer before return. Does that clarify things?
And the stack pointer moves twice, right? Because we pop and then return.
So in our example, the stack pointer moves twice because yes, we also have pops in addition to the return. So for example, I guess I can annotate this. This gadget, this consumes two values from the stack, as does this. This consumes just one value from the stack. That makes sense? Yeah, and sometimes, you know, practically speaking, we'll find gadgets which consume like three or four values from the stack. This is actually very common because if you think of functions that you've seen in assembly, if they're using lots of temporary values, the compiler will like push a lot of things and then pop a lot of things. And that's where we can get these gadgets that pop things into registers. One of the places we find these gadgets that pop things into registers. So we often will find a big sequence. Questions? Okay. So we've gone over kind of the mechanics of this return-oriented programming idea. There's some practical issues we kind of have skipped over. And one is, how do I find these gadgets? And it seemed like I had to get kind of pretty tricky, right? Like here to find my pop RAX, I found it in something that, you know, I couldn't just like object dump libc and grep easily. And you might say, well, I gave this example, how did I find this? You know, and I'm not good at looking at the object dump output. There are tools to do this, including one you'll use in an upcoming homework. So we're going to want to find these gadgets, and we've seen kind of the form of these gadgets, and basically we just want bits of machine code that go to another bit of machine code. So we can chain them together. And for finding them, most commonly we're interested in the ones that end in return, but they don't actually have to end in the return. Like they could also end in the jump or a call. So how do we make a program that finds these? This is a pretty mechanical process. It does involve having like a library that does disassembly. And it involves knowing a bit, looking up probably a lot about the machine code encoding on x86 of instructions. But basically you figure out how are returns, jumps, and calls encoded. And you search for bytes that could be interpreted as a return, a jump, or a call. And then you search, you disassemble that, you go a byte before, try to disassemble that, see if you end up with the same return, jump, or call. Go a byte, two bytes before, see if you do that, and you get these little code snippets for the ones that successfully disassemble to still include the return, jump, or call of potential gadgets. And sometimes they won't disassemble. Like sometimes it will end up being that if you start two bytes before, that's an invalid instruction. Like you just described that. Or sometimes it will end up being that, you know, like in this case, if we went, here's our return. If we go one byte before, we get something useful. If we go two bytes before, we get a completely different instruction. We just have to discard those. So we get that list, we just sort it, and output it. And there's a tool you'll use called ROPGadget, which does precisely this. So it just gives you this giant sorted list of all the gadgets it finds. A lot of them maybe don't be useful, but you can just search for ones that are interesting, and now you can search for the assembly operands you want to find. Questions about this, like what are gadget finding tools doing? Okay, so we have this list of gadgets. There's some things we might want to actually filter besides like what we're looking for. And I want to mention that RRP Gaijin and most other tools of this sort have options for that. So there's like two practical issues that this list kind of ignores. So one of them is that if you've looked at like things in a debugger, you've probably never seen anything in an address like this. And that's because the addresses we're seeing here are the ones we see in object dump. Like it's basically getting the object dump information. But we know that in position-independent executables, which includes binls on the system I ran this on, that's not going to be loaded at that address. So to practically do this attack, we're going to need to figure out where is binls actually loaded and adjust the address of every single gadget accordingly. And that's pretty easy to automate. So there is, in fact, an option to RRP Gaijin to adjust all the gadget addresses by an offset. The other issue is that a bunch of these gadgets assume that we can insert kind of weird bytes in our buffer overflow. And sometimes that will be true, sometimes it will not be true. So if we can't insert weird bytes, we'd like to filter those gadgets out. And RRP Gaijin also has an option for that, which is, so offset x, which is dash dash bad bytes. And you can list, I believe, hex values, you know. Something like, I don't remember the, I'd have to look up the syntax, but you can list the bytes that you cannot input and have it just not show you those gadgets because you can't use them. And so that's, you know, example of these tools. And so this is kind of, you know, gives us kind of the toolkit we need. And, you know, with this design, it seems like, okay, we can do these things, but we're going to be solving a, it seems like we're going to be solving a mega difficult version of this exercise. Or maybe easier, hard to say. Some version of this exercise where we have the luxury and pain of having a much, 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 much longer list of things. Maybe a luxury because, you know, we can maybe find more convenient gadgets. Maybe a pain because almost certainly like 80% of the gadgets we find are going to be useless to us for our specific needs. But the thing is that this is more automatable than it looks. So I think it's generally true that, you know, as far as like the maximum capability, sometimes, you know, we're going to have to look by hand. But often, you know, we just want to do one thing. And RRP Gaijin, that tool I've shown you, has, actually has a mode for trying to automate this. And there are other kind of common patterns where we can imagine making an automated tool. And how do we automate it? Well, the way RRP chain works is that it looks for kind of gadgets that match a specific pattern. So it says, I want to find something that lets me write to memory at a particular location. Can I find something that does that? And it has sort of patterns it knows that match that. And it wants to find, I want to find a gadget that lets me load into RDI. Let me find one of those. And it has some patterns of common gadgets you're likely to see that do that. And I want to find a gadget that makes a system call, looks for something that does. So it just, that's the design idea for why you can automate this, is that it's not guaranteed, but RRP Gaijin, that tool here, it's using actually a pretty stupid technique. It just has like kind of a list of, if the assembly map looks like this, it's the gadget I want, and we're just relying on the fact that if we have a big program, we're likely to find gadgets matching a lot of these patterns, especially if the gadget we're looking for like is only like 4 bytes of machine code. And that's especially because, you know, we'll have this lock of constants that happen to match up and across a multi-megabyte binary. It's likely to happen a bunch of times. So ROP gadget has a mode where it will just do that. So here I'm finding a chain, assuming for using gadgets in libc, assuming that libc is loaded at this particular offset. And it's using these heuristics where it's saying, I'm looking for a way. So probably what it did is using a similar strategy to what I showed in that exercise. It wants to write binsh somewhere in memory. So it looked for a way of doing that. It found this. It said, okay, now I need to find a gadget that loads RDX and REX. It said, oh, I found this for loading RDX and this for loading REX. And it just combined them together. And you can see, like, it's not trivial, but you can see how this is automated and we're not doing any, like, intelligent automation, really. This is just, we hard-coded a pattern that works almost most of the time. Questions? Now, sometimes this won't work. So RP gadget like outputs for your information, like what it does when it's finding a chain. And in this example, I ran it on binls and it says, oh, couldn't find it. You know, I was looking for a gadget which matched this pattern and I couldn't find one. What, you know, sorry. Too bad. That doesn't mean it's not possible, because ROP gadget is using this kind of just, I hope we have exactly that instruction. But there's other ways we could do that, more complicated things. And there's probably other tools out there. I wanted to demo AngerUp, which is a tool that uses kind of symbolic execution-based techniques. So it kind of keeps track of, oh, the value of this register is this function of the input. I couldn't get it to work consistently quickly, so I probably don't want to have you pretend that you're just going to easily use it without me doing more setup. But there are more complicated tools out there that will handle more cases, and people just do it by hand often. They'll just say, you know, this is a puzzle I need to solve. I have these toolkits to build things together. And yeah, I should do here. On automated chain finding, let's see if I can do this. So to do the live demo, so we can show what this looks like. Oh, did I? Oh, right, it's at the bottom. So we can see our list of gadgets. So you can see it's sort of, I probably should have redirected this to a file. Definitely should have redirected this to a file. So if we look at the bottom of this file, we can see it produced our sort of chain with the heuristic, but you can see it tells you what steps its sort of basic heuristics are using to do that. It says, I want gadgets that write values to a particular place. Let's look for, you know, let's look for candidates. I mean, find these various ways of writing. Oh, but I need to make, you know, how do I make this work? And eventually find something it can use with its heuristics. It needs to set system call numbers. It needs to initialize registers. So they use the stupidest possible way of just set a register to zero and then increment it. And we need to set arguments. Okay, we look for pops of those. we need a syscall, and then it just, this is an older version than the one you have, which is why it says Python 2. You'll have a Python 3 version of this. But you can see it just then puts together Python code that produces the string we want to line up with the return address. And it has a lot of redundancy because of their strategy of incrementing a value over and over again, rather than just setting it to something. Questions on our chain finding? Okay, so one of the big kind of heuristics we've used is that we're always looking for the gadgets with returns. And this isn't necessary. You might say, why would we care about this? Well, it's because if we're thinking about defending against this, defending against it by protecting all our returns seems maybe feasible. We'll talk about whether is it really feasible, but it seems maybe feasible. But one problem with this idea is that there are gadgets that, you know, where we can kind of avoid that. So one way we can avoid that is we can look for a gadget if that, like, let's say we don't have a Stack Overflow. We can, I guess, I should start with, I have the wrong size. So one thing we can do is that we don't need gadgets that always end in return, but return gadgets are the ones we're going to find the most easily. So the most common strategy for dealing with what if we don't start with we can't start with just a return. And I'm going to talk about first, some way of getting around things on the stack is what if we have a non-Stack Overflow? So, we don't have a stack exploit. We successfully perfected our stack pointer with stack canaries. So we don't have a Stack Overflow. How do we use ROP chains? In that case, it seems like we can, right? That kind of the whole idea of ROP chains is that we overflow the return address and we have stuff after it that's really important. And it seems like other exploits wouldn't give us this kind of scenario. So I'm gonna talk about how do we work around this, and this one strategy for working around this is that we can change where the stack pointer is. I'll talk about a second strategy for working around this, which is why I got confused, sorry, which is that we can also work around it where we don't rely on using the stack. And why would we want to do that? Well, we talked about shadow stacks, right? Shadow stacks seem to completely break this idea of having things return to the wrong place. But there's a workaround we'll talk about later. But first we'll talk about kind of the simpler case. We just have the issue we're trying to work around is just that we don't have a Stack Overflow. I can't overwrite a return address in somewhere else. Instead, I have something like we see in our pointer subterfuge assignment, where we can overwrite a function pointer, but we can't just make that overwrite the stack. So one idea might be that let's say we have these two gadgets here. And the most interesting of these gadgets is this one here, popRSP. And this probably isn't a real instruction in the program, but it's probably a misreading of a real instruction. And so our idea is going to be that if we can run this popRSP gadget with something on top of the stack that is a different buffer, we can put our ROP chain there instead of on the stack. And we're going to combine that with this first gadget, which writes a value to the stack from RDI. And RDI, conveniently, is the first argument to the current function. So if we overwrote a function pointer, we'd push the value that we passed into it onto the stack, and then that would become the stack. And we could do our ROP chain that way. So with this sequence of gadgets, we can have a scenario where if we have a function pointer, we can overwrite and we control the arguments to the function. We can overwrite the function pointer to point to gadget one. We can set the argument, the third argument to the function, to somehow be the value of a pointer to gadget two. And we can then, you know, have our stack pointer become whatever's in the first argument. And kind of the example of vulnerable code would be that if we're doing, you know, some function pointer calling with a function pointer, you know, a string from input, anything, and a number from input. That we as the attacker, if we've overwritten this function pointer earlier, can now, you know, by choosing the string and the integer, we can now have that string be an ROP chain to run, and this kind of sequence of gadgets will do that. Some questions? This idea. And I'm mentioning this because this helps explain kind of one thing which might, you know, which comes up very often, which is often we'll have a vtable pointer overwrite or something like that, where the way we'll exploit it is by overwriting it with a gadget, with some one of these sequences that we'll use, even though the overflow is not on the stack. The most common way, sort of strategy for exploiting these non-stack overflows when we have no ability to write shellcode and run it is to use these ROP chains, which we set up with these sort of gadgets that set the stack. So as an example here, I have a class bar with a buffer followed by a pointer to another object that has a vtable. And so I'm going to want to run code. And if I already had the code I wanted, you know, so I'm going to overwrite the buffer. And then probably the first part of my setup is I, you know, overwrite it. And let's say I make foo point back to the buffer. So it thinks the vtable pointer is there. And if we could execute code in this buffer, we'd set up the scenario where this points over here, and this points to our shell code here. What would happen is when we do this method call, the compiler is going to follow this pointer to get to here. That's going to be the address of the actual implementation of this method, because we have polymorphism, we don't know what subclass of foo it is. And we're going to end up calling our method, which is actually running this shellcode. So that would be the version of this attack without return-oriented programs. Questions about that? So with return-oriented programming, we can't do this step where we point to the shell code. So instead, we're going to have to make this point to a gadget. So we're going to step through what the version of that looks like. So we're going to have it point to our fake vtable. And in our fake vtable, we're going to say, I should use a different code, that this is our fake vtable, that the pointer for that method, some method, is implemented by a gadget. And let's say the gadget we find is this one. Push RDX, jump to what R is I want. Well, in that case, if we look at what the method call works to, well, RDX is going to be here. RSI is going to be Rx that hopefully we control. RDX is going to put it there, and RDX is going to be RY. So we can set the Y, the value that gets pushed, and we can jump to where RSI points to. So in this example, we'll set RSI to be a pointer to our actual gadget somehow, which probably we'll do by making a pointer here that RSI points to, that points to our next gadget in the chain. So we're chaining gadgets together here, but we're not using a return, we're using a jump. And awkwardly, it's not a jump to RSI, it's a read memory at RSI, find an address there, then jump there. So we have some extra steps. This is often a thing that unfortunately happens. But that's what we're doing. And we'll hope that we can point this onto our next gadget that actually like sets the stack and runs something else. So that would be our simplest version of this talk. So questions? So about this idea that we can use these gadgets without a stack overwrite, we just need, we can use them like little functions. We're finding candidate functions in the program that weren't intended and combining them together. And often we'll look for functions where we can somehow pass something to the function that says what to do next. Okay, so there's this idea, that's a kind of a variant of ROP, called jump-oriented programming. So we showed some examples where we incidentally used gadgets, that had a jump instead of a return. But the primary way I suggested using them is we'll do that, set RSP, and then use the normal gadgets, the ones that end in return. But we can actually relatively consistently, though it's a bunch more work, you can make this work even if you have no return-based gadgets. And you might say, well, we can do that sometimes. Why would this be consistent? Why would this be something we could set up, and not have it be like we do a lot of research on the gadgets in this particular program and figure out how to chain them together? Like, how could we make this kind of consistent? So the trick is we look for what the original paper about this calls a dispatcher gadget. So this is an example of a dispatcher gadget. So can someone tell me how are we going to imagining? Using this gadget. What makes this useful? Yeah.
Maybe RCX points to the beginning of a buffer, and so if we wanted to jump to, if we stored a pointer in our buffer,
then we'll jump to that. Okay. So your idea is RCX points to the beginning of a buffer. Yeah. And if we run this repeatedly, it jumps to the second thing in the buffer, then the third, then the fourth, then the fifth, assuming we don't have something else changing RCX. And so that's the idea of these dispatcher gadgets, that we find this one gadget which kind of advances in a buffer, and that kind of serves the same thing we were using the stack for. So like the cool thing about chaining things in return on a program, the reason why that worked is because we have this list of things to run kind of inherent in how return works. This is not a return, but like return, it inherently has a list of things to run. And so, as for actually using this, our idea would be that we'd set up some registers to point to this gadget or point to a pointer to this gadget. And then we look for gadgets that that ended with jumps using those registers. And I think this is probably not too hard in practice if we think of vtable calls, right? Vtable calls often end up using code that looks like this, or maybe a call instead of a jump, which probably works the same for the purposes of this. So we could probably, so we can actually assemble this together. We still need to do a bunch of very specific hard work of how do we set all the registers for this correctly to start things. But the idea is that we're not solving the problem of how do I actually run my arbitrary code? We're solving the problem of just setting some registers to values, which is probably a lot easier to solve. And once we've done that, we can pretty much do whatever we want by changing the contents of this big buffer. Questions? This jump-oriented programming idea. Okay. Let's do some exercises. So we talked about our simpler idea is I want to use sort of one gadget to start an RO region. And so let's say we found a gadget that does that, and the gadget I found is move RSP, RSI, the second argument, into RSP, and return. So probably this is not a real instruction in the program, probably it's a misreading of another instruction, but it's a very convenient one because it sets the stack pointer and then returns. And here, I have something where I have a function pointer after a buffer, and I have an overwrite that can overwrite that function pointer, and I also extract a decimal number and a string from that buffer for my arguments. So let's say I set up the function pointer to point to this gadget. What should I put in the string to make this work? You can check with your neighbors, see if you agree on what. I guess, because I want to try to go over this, we'll take a show of hands. So who thinks egg? We should just start it with shellcode. Put shellcode in the input. Thinks B, we should put an ROP chain at the beginning of the input. Thinks C, we should put the address of the shellcode or some existing function in decimal at the beginning of the input. D, we should put the address of the ROP chain in decimal, okay. And E, we should put the address of a return. Okay, so we have this here. And I think probably the simplest way to do this attack, so it depends what addresses we know, what address we put, but if we say know the address of input here, we could put our ROP chain in the middle of the buffer and just point to it in the middle of the buffer. So maybe our input would be the address of chain, comma, something, and then the chain, and then something, and then after 1,000 bytes, the gadget address. So that would be the setup for this attack here. And in this case, it would be done with one input, probably in most realistic scenarios for these sorts of attacks. We're thinking of something like a vulnerability in a server or a browser. So we'll actually set things up over a whole lot of inputs. So questions, this idea, I feel like I fumbled things. I know RIP chains, I should try to, right, I have a slide on this. But so we'll do some other exercises on this. I know RIP chains are kind of hard to understand in practice, and I would like people to understand it because they're how we do modern exploits, because most people, despite my example of F5 in 2021, are smart enough to enable like kind of all the protections we talked about. And so we have to do something that works around non-executable memory. So this is kind of all modern exploits, for the most part, use this kind of technique. Okay, so that's where I'll finish up today. We'll try to review some of this tomorrow, Friday, and maybe go on to our next topic if we have time, of bounds checking, of like, how do we prevent overflows?